Hello and welcome to the Blind Shots Podcast. I'm your host, David Hill, coming to you from the back porch at the fields in LaGrange, Georgia, staring out over the 9th and 18th greens, completely contented with the golf walk I've just completed. And this is Season 5, Episode 12. For contemporaneous listeners, happy Masters Week. And while most all of your eyes are going to be on Augusta, Georgia, I'm going to turn your attention to a special golf course on the other side of the state, the aforementioned The Fields in LaGrange, Georgia. Sometimes a town, a place, an experience will just grab me and not let go. It finds a way into my consciousness. It forges a connection stronger than I could rationally explain to a stranger. And it happens to me every once in a while, and it certainly happened in earnest last year when I visited The Fields. Baked out, running fast and firm under the cruel Georgia sun, the course felt like Scotland. The darling downtown reminded me so much of how I remember Bowling Green as a little kid. Really, the whole scene just speaks to me, to my nostalgia, my love of things off the beaten path, and perhaps the rose-colored glasses through which I view an underdog story. And what golf architect Mike Young and his son Ashley Young, the general manager down at The Fields, have done to bring that course back from the scrap heap is phenomenal. Sure, it's a little rugged in spots and perennially going to be a work in progress, but it's an intensely fun and plenty challenging core golf course that's provided two of my favorite golf walks probably the last decade. And it's a place with a story worth telling. And to tell you a little of the story of The Fields, today I'm bringing you the story of the storyteller. In this episode, I sit down for a chat with Hagan O'Neill, the man behind From Red Clay to Fairways, a documentary by Palmer Pictures. I was on site at The Fields in 2023 for the movie's world premiere screening. It's an entertaining, funny, engaging bit of storytelling that uses The Fields' phoenix-like rise to discuss not only the personalities and milestones of the course and community, but also the relevance and importance of public golf, the value propositions of organizations like the USGA and the PGA of America, and how the golf course industry moves forward. With Hagan's permission, I've embedded the film on this episode's page over at onebeardedgolfer.com. It's about a half an hour long, and I really think you'll like it. After you watch it, I bet my conversation with Hagan will make more sense. Instead of just rehashing the film, we talk about his origin story, his process, and what's next for a caddy-turned-aspiring filmmaker in the not-quite-bustling artist scene about an hour south of downtown Atlanta. So go check that out right now. Go watch it now. Don't worry. We'll wait. As you're navigating over to onebeardedgolfer.com to find the video, a reminder that the Blind Shots podcast is made possible without commercial interruption or the use of a ticket lottery system by my day job as David Hill Realtor with Rector Hayden Realtors. I help people sell their houses and find their new homes, as well as helping investors and businesses with their commercial property needs here in Central Kentucky. Our local market is heated right back up after the winter doldrums and has gotten very competitive in the first-time homebuyer space. So if you have a need, if you want to talk purchasing strategy, or just have some even basic real estate questions, please reach out. You can email me at davidhill@rhr.com or give me a call at 859-333-4517, and I'll be happy to get a conversation started. Now, with all that out of the way, here comes my conversation with Hagan. Apologies in advance. Part of the way through our chat, I suffered a devastatingly embarrassing technical failure. After about 10 minutes of intermission, where each second felt like an hour as I fumbled through Googling how to empty space on a full SD memory card, we were able to pick up near where we left off and continue on. I've slapped an explicit tag on this episode because Hagan and I were both a tad punchy as we recorded in the evening hours after our round together that afternoon. And one last thing, I want to give a big thank you to Ashley Young for his incredible hospitality on my return visit to The Fields. Ashley, thank you for opening up your shop and your office to me, giving me the opportunity to shine a tad more light on The Fields and on Hagan's wonderful film. You guys are the best. Here's the episode. So, Hagan, what was your introduction to The Fields?
My introduction to The Fields is my mom was a teacher. And at the tail end of COVID, being a teacher in Florida, at the middle of COVID, they told teachers that they needed to go back in the classroom. And she said, no, I will not go back to the classroom. And she'd been wanting to move from Florida for a while, so she retired and was looking in the Tennessee area, North Carolina area, and ended up buying a house in Luthersville, Georgia. So when I came to visit, I looked for golf courses nearby to play, maybe like around Christmas time or something in 2021 or 22. And I came and I played one time. It was like the best price and most interesting looking, you know. I feel like you can tell a fair deal from a Google, you know, Google search of nearby golf courses of what's a good golf course. I came out here one time and I think I only played the front nine. And then I went to go back to New York to finish the season caddying, or caddy a full season, a full summer. And the whole time I was in New York, I was excited to come back and play because I was going to stay here for the winter. And I was excited to be able to come here and walk for a reasonable price and a golf course that I enjoyed and liked. And then coming back, the first day I came back, I met Ashley in the pro shop. And it's been a very beautiful relationship since.
I would say so. The golf course is the star, or is the, you know, the golf course is the subject of your film. Mm-hmm. From red clays to fairway.
From that? Red clay to fairway, yeah.
Yeah. But I don't know that your film has a star because for the casual observer, it's storytelling, but it's community. It's a resurrection story. It's public golf. There are so many different things that you touched on in the film. But I'm with you. The first time I walked it, you get the feeling that's a pretty special place. Now, what kind of places were you caddying in New York, just in relation to
Exactly. I mean, I have like a weird where I really learned how to play golf was a municipal golf course in Pompano, Florida, where for $100, we talked about that earlier, for $100 for the year, a junior could walk for free, so my mom would drop me off. And that place, I mean, there was, you know, dirt patches everywhere and, you know, not the best golf course. A public golf course, and it was good and it served its purpose, but not a special one like places like the Fields are. But then I would play there, but then I also grew up working at country clubs designed by Donald Ross and caddying at places like Wingfoot and places like, there's a place, Spanish Oaks in Texas, where they're trying to be kind of like the Augusta National, you know.
There's a certain aesthetic to the types of courses that you're talking about for the caddying, sort of a, those sound like very nice golf courses.
Like Mike said in the documentary, where they're concerned about flat screen TVs being over the urinals, where that matters as much as the golf course, or that they have to spray whatever chemical they can for the golf course to be beautiful. And those places serve a purpose, and they're around because people like them. But I wanted to show that there are places that can do things a natural way, and for there to be blemishes and it to be special. And I think that's what the field says.
So you got your first impression and fell. How long between that first round, that first winner, and figuring out the story of the Fields? Because this place has a pretty unique story of with the Young family and how it's come full circle for them. When did you learn about that?
So when I came back after that summer caddying and I met Ashley, anytime I saw him, we'd have a, you know, 20, 30 minute chat of like an actual good conversation. Not like I felt like he was holding me from going somewhere, I was holding him. Like we were excited to see each other and talking. I didn't really know anything until I started making the documentary, which is a beautiful way to go about it. And which is why while filming the documentary, the story changed multiple times. And the amount that I filmed, like, could have told three or four different stories.
That's interesting. So what was your origin story? How did your filmmaking process?
It was pretty close to the final product, but while doing it, it strayed away. But just how a place like this operates, and how it relates to the rest of the golf community and to the blossoming new age of golf, which I think is steering away from a lot of the traditions or it needing to be Augusta or perfect, you know? But it was that. But through filming, it was changing from the micro or macro of it being, well, how is Ashley, what is he doing? Like deleting bunkers? Like, do we want to show that and what they're physically doing? Or do we just want to show them doing the work and just let that be so people see it's, you know, a small crew, but what it's yielding and how that relates to other courses, bigger courses, and just the overall trends.
You know, the film, again, kind of tells the journey of, but not just the young family, but what they found when they got re-engaged, you know, with the staff, the legacy staff that was able to stay on. Mm-hmm. You know, one of the things, you talk a lot about public golf, but one of the things for me, just receiving the film, it's like, this is one of the models for community golf. Mm. And, you know, public golf means different things mm-hmm. to different people. This is a place, as we're at the fields today, that anybody can come and play, but it's all, there's not a city commission running. This isn't a parks department project. This mm-hmm. is the ownership kind of figuring it out as they go. Mm-hmm. What kind of feedback have you gotten from the golf community with the film being out there? Anything that stuck out?
I mean, really just people like yourself that were just excited to see it. I think I would like to make films. And I wasn't interested in starting a YouTube golf content channel. I doom scroll on golf content like the rest, like anybody. But I think the main thing was, I just tried to tell a story, you know, not promote a brand or, you know, have there be a BMW logo as somebody was driving up. And, you know, I'm calling out No Laying Up because I saw one of the things that they did that. They're driving up and this, you know, new BMW is so great, isn't it? Now I'm talking shit. But I think I haven't gotten much, honestly, not as much as I was really hoping. There was a few people that said they were going to promote it that didn't, which is frustrating, but I think that it's reached the people that it needed to. And I think to finally answer your question, at the premiere, Ashley Young, Larry, Shelby, Maddie, who works in the pro shop and kind of runs the pro shop, who refused to be in it, all were basically in tears and appreciative and felt like I told the story correctly and honestly. And to me, that's all that really matters.
That's all a lot of us want, is yeah. Just to be recognized
sure.
for just who we are, what we do. Mm-hmm. Filmmaking is something that you do. I have a feeling that you want to do more. Mm-hmm. First love, earlier love, golf or film?
I probably never.
I'll put it to you this
yeah,
way.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
So as a kid, yeah. sunny day.
Yeah.
You can stay inside and watch movies all day, or you can head to the golf course.
I would probably do both. I'd probably watch a movie, go play golf, and then watch a movie. But I also have the affliction of finding interest, which I'm hoping I can stay and focus on film. But when I was a kid, I mean, I didn't start really playing golf until I was 15, and then I was addicted, you know, that Irish addictive gene I have. So once I started playing golf, it was the bug, the full, you know, watching hours of YouTube videos. But films, you know, I mean, I remember, specifically remember my dad would, like, let me miss school if there was, like, a new Star Wars movie or something like that. So golf and movie was something that we both really bonded over.
So Florida, not necessarily the artistic capital.
I call myself a closeted artistic man.
So one of the things I was interested in, because this process came to life here in what do we call this? Is this Central Georgia? We're about an hour south of Atlanta.
I have no fucking idea.
Right? But one of the things I'm interested, I want to know, what is the artist community for someone like you that is young, has ambition and aspiring and has ideas? You know, I have a feeling that if you were making this film in – Metro New York, it would be a very different experience for you. So talk to me just a little bit about, you know, you got your inspiration from the land and from the people, but what was the process like for you and trying to find what you needed?
Well, only recently have I sort of found a community. I've always felt like I was kind of creating on my own. But myself and I can call him my partner, Evan Westerfield, were the only two people. And he lives in Jacksonville, so he would come up and like stay for a week and we would film. And he was just, we didn't even have a boom stand. He was just holding the mic in his hand. And some of the takes we couldn't use because he'd switch hands and it sounded, I won't do it to your mic, but it's like somebody was, you know, it went through a washing machine.
People pound on the table.
Well, I'm an audio purist. I'm not going to mess you up like that. But it was just us, you know. But that was part of the process of, I wanted to learn how to do sound. I wanted to have to hold the camera. I wanted to be, you know, be in control to learn everything, because I knew I wanted to make films. I didn't want to spend time in school, and I wanted to make a documentary because I felt like learning the behind the camera stuff and not worrying about an actor's performance or writing a script, it would free me up to be able to focus on all those things and not be stressed and not be insecure and just capture, which I think is what I'm best at. So just doing that and having to do it all was stressful, but the best experience I could have had. And then from that, gaining the confidence to collaborate with people and be able to find it. But when we were doing it, it felt very isolated in a good way, but very kind of on an island making this thing and hoping it was good.
I mean, we're in beautiful LaGrange, Georgia, which, again, reminds me of my hometown, beloved of Bowling Green, which, you know, there was a little downtown capital, the little theater on the town square that would put on, that's where the high school would put on their productions. And, but, you know, that was a university town. So, you know, I've been here last summer. There was a little artist fair, I think, down at the farmer's market. And it just struck me. I was like, I was impressed that you were able to kind of up from the bootstraps, find the gumption and figure out what you needed to figure out kind of out there on the wire on your own.
I mean, as far as the documentary is concerned, well, that's YouTube degrees all the way. I mean, YouTube is a gorgeous place.
How crazy did you want to go on equipment spending? Because we're sitting here, we've got two mics and a Zoom, and maybe if I add it all up, a couple $100s, and that was me not hitting the purchase button on Amazon in the middle of the pandemic.
Yeah.
As far as creating basically your studio.
Yeah.
Like, what was that process? Was that frustrating? Were you just kind of shoestring budget? Or did you?
I had, from the season I had caddied at Metropolis Country Club, beautiful country club plug, maybe I had like $1,500. And then I was talking to my dad about maybe needing a little more, and he said when he opened a restaurant, his dad made him make kind of a business plan of exactly what the expenses were, of what he needed to buy and what the prices were, and whatever was left over, he would help me out.
For perspective, if you want to, listeners, go on eBay and just look at a... Just type in Canon 35mm camera.
So, this is the end of Act 1. Welcome to the intermission. What Hagen and I continued discussing accidentally off air was the fact that the barriers to entry for things like photography, podcasting, filmmaking aren't necessarily super high, but they can escalate wildly without a lot of effort. Kind of like with golf equipment. The transition from a starter set or an old hand-me-down bag of clubs can destroy the scorecard of your budget pretty quickly with chasing the newest, latest, and greatest clubs. Don't believe me? Spend a couple minutes on eBay looking at mid-range Canon or Nikon cameras, even used ones, and a few zoom lenses, and maybe even a microphone rig. Then look at video recording equipment. Then maybe a Rodecaster microphone set. Add in a light, and maybe some stands, and all of a sudden, Once that snowball gets started, it can be hard for it to stop before you're at the bottom of the mountain with several thousand dollars of equipment scattered around your office. Is it still a hobby at that point? Is it a career? Is it going to be the most awesome yard sale of all time? Who can say? Anyway, back to the show. Here's Act Two. And we're back. So, in the...
Where were we?
Where were we, indeed. So, you were able to combine two of your passions in your first project. Documentary, Red Clays to Fairways here at the Fields. You mentioned the reception. We're going to work on getting a little more attention on that. Look, I'm. Sure. I loved my day at the Fields. I loved catching the premiere. I was happy when I pulled up to see an association with McKellar Magazine.
Our boy Tommy Dunn, the best. Or at least that's how I know McKellar.
Tell me about your origin story with him. With Tom, I love this. I asked Tom, I ask you, how did you guys hook up? How did McKellar get involved?
I forget how Tom, or it was just like a first tee pairing, you know, and it was love at first sight. I think I had just finished caddying for the day and I went to go play one of the municipals in New York for fucking, you know, $80 or some BS. But I was walking, he was walking, and by the second green, you know, we were just cutting it up and having a really good time, and I really respect how he thinks about golf, how he thinks about life. We share a lot of similar interests in music and movies, and he's just a fantastic guy. He's one of my favorite people to talk to and know.
I don't know if he gets it, but he really is one of the best.
Yeah.
You know, I think
sometimes he knows and sometimes he forgets, but right. He is the best.
I'm not surprised that he found you. You know, he's been a writer for a long time, so yeah. He can sniff out a good story. So I'm not surprised.
Well, he was the one. So before the thing ended, we talked about stuff that got left out of the film, which I do want to go back to because I think there is some important stuff. But I actually gained the confidence to want to make films after I officiated a wedding, funny enough. But it was one of the first things I had to share that I wrote to a group of people. It's like 200 people or something. And it was very well received, and it was fun to do, and I felt like I did a good job, and people told, you know, that validation shit that we all need. But I mean, when the photographer came up to me and said he hasn't cried at a wedding in 15 years, and he cried 3 times, I was like, well, I'm on to something, you know? But that gave me the confidence to do it, and then, like I said, I wanted to make a documentary before film. And I wanted and still want to make a caddy documentary. I mean, we talked about that while we were playing earlier. I don't think, respectively, a true caddy documentary has been made. Not about the history of caddying or the benefits of it, but just what the job is and what the relationship is between player and caddy at a normal golf course. And I don't care about, I mean, respect to Bones or Joey LaCava, those guys are awesome, but they have their limelight. But I think the people work, you know, the guys working 36 holes at a country club every day for a summer to feed their family or to be able to enjoy the winter is beautiful, and the relationships are beautiful. I told that to Tom. He goes, I think that's a little lofty for your first idea. You've been playing at the Fields. Mike Young is a very interesting character. I mean, he didn't really know about Ashley, but I think Ashley really shines through in the documentary and what he's doing here. And I think he, what's the word I'm looking for? Where he shows there are a lot of people like Ashley in the world. He personifies, maybe, that's not the right word, but what a lot of people do. So Tom was the one that steered me towards the Field story. And
he's a good editor. Everybody needs a good editor.
He's a very soft but firm push into the direction you need to be heading.
Yeah. You know, we're sitting here in Georgia in late March, and really, I think 99% of the public, as close as they know to caddy tales, are
whatever gets spun up in the run up to the Masters. You know, there's some famous caddy stories there. Ben Crenshaw.
Even that, I mean, I've seen some of the clips on YouTube of like the Augusta National stories, or like, was it Fuzzy Zeller? He like stopped asking questions, or just like the caddy basically like told him exactly where to putt. Like, those are stories are awesome, but I think to just like strap microphones on to, you know, two caddies and four players at a golf course and just film them walking down a fairway and having a conversation, or what they do when they leave, both caddy and player, and not really like explain much or have, you know, like voiceover or like interview. I mean, maybe some interviews, but like just showing it, I think would be interesting. Or some of the, I mean, I don't know. Have you ever caddied before?
I've not. I've taken caddies, and I'll say that my only input on that is there's a little different experience. I've taken caddies at Bandon Dunes, which is a public resort.
Yeah.
So that's kind of a
it's kind of a factory style.
Right. I mean, there may be repeat business. Yeah. Some guys might come out there every year, but there's not a lot of local play. My best caddy experience was in Scotland, which again, okay, the old course has that factory mentality, but you know, every little town has these caddies that are such a tight-knit community.
Yeah.
You know, that would be interesting. So kind of taking that from growing up a gypsy in public golf, you know, I've only had a few caddy experiences. But the places you're talking about where a caddying is a profession, you know, it can be a summer job for college kids, but can also be, it is some of those guys.
Solid summer job as well.
Right. But it's also a profession.
Yeah.
And it may be, there are definitely stories there.
Yeah. And I think a place like where I want to do is Metropolis, where I've been working the past few years in White Plains, New York. Unfortunately, I got the approval from, after I did the fields, I pushed forward with that, or kind of while I was filming, I was still reaching out. And I got approval from the course, but the third party caddy company is Caddy Master. And it went up to Troon, but nobody called me. They kept calling like the caddy master at Metropolis, Ryan Jensen. He's like, I don't, you know, just talk to Hagen. Nobody wanted to talk to me, and they put the kibosh on it because they thought it'd be a bad look. Somebody could sue, but they're just scared because they're making people work without health insurance. But which is frustrating because I think that place is special. But what I was trying to say is, if you've been a caddy, some of the most interesting conversations you'll ever have in your life are before or after you've caddied with other caddies sitting in a little shaded area somewhere. And those conversations can be as gross as people could imagine, and they could be as profound that people would be surprised at. And when people with so many different backgrounds, so many different age groups are sitting around, it's very interesting what can be said.
Is it a strict hierarchy of seniority and age, or?
I mean, the best caddy normally wins. In a place like Metropolis, where you can be requested by members, the cream rises to the top a little bit. You know, like the people have been there for a long time, they have their loops. But sometimes somebody else can come in and sweep in and take it. So it is, and that's the other thing, you could get some drama. I mean, there are some people yelling about, you know, you took this loop, you took that loop. Caddy masters get yelled at quite often for not giving loops or thinking that there's foul play going on. But normally the best caddy wins. But there's also different types of caddies for different players, you know. Some people just want to chat. Some people want the number. Some people want you to shut the fuck up.
You know, what you're describing, it sounds like you are talking writer, producer, director stuff. Not necessarily just behind a camera. You're trying to create your own opportunity.
I mean, you kind of have to do it. Nobody's going to give you a script or a story and let you do it. You kind of have to come up with it at this point in my life, career, whatever.
Right. Where I'm going with that is, you came to film as a passion. I'm assuming with the golf and the caddy, and you didn't have time. You weren't a theater kid growing up.
I did like a children's theater. Like I said, in Florida, I was a closeted creative kid or artistic kid, but I felt like I was supposed to be playing baseball and golf or drinking Natty Light at the semi-appropriate age. But yeah, I mean, I definitely think I would love to go up and caddy like in the summer just to save some money, but it is very draining. Like I don't have much time to like write a script after you've caddied 27 holes in June. You know, it takes a lot.
I can see it. You know, my tagline is at the end of every podcast is sit up straight, drink lots of water, and then I send people out. And that solves a lot of the world's problems. But yeah, at the end of, you know, when your feet hurt that bad, I could, my group, I told, you know, we go all over, and when we go to walking only courses, fatigue is, you know, we play 36 a day. So sure, the guys that are carrying double bags, yeah.
Yeah. And not everybody is as conscious of the amount of golf balls that are in their bags, you know.
I got shit. Now, my one bone of contention. So I did a really good job of slimming down my bag, only having the essentials. And the caddy still said, nope. He pulled my clubs out and put it into his pink hoofer.
Yeah. It's not going to rain today. You don't need this umbrella.
It wasn't my water bottle was in there, and it was a giant water bottle, and he didn't take that into account. I would have carried the freaking water bottle, but whatever. It was his.
You got to sit up straight. You got to stay hydrated. He wasn't listening.
I guess he didn't know about the Blind Shots podcast.
He did not. Not yet.
Tell me about the short film. So the documentary on the fields isn't your only work. You were able to fundraise, mm-hmm, which is, again, you're self-produced.
Yeah, Kickstarter. I mean, I felt very insecure or bad about asking friends and family for money, but they were, a lot of people,
that's
were
how we know you're a good
supportive
guy.
Yeah everybody was very supportive, and it was a good lesson to do, but I'd much rather, in hopefully the near future, reach out to people who want to produce movies. And also, a short film isn't going to make any fucking money, you know. Right. So you're basically asking for a donation. The game of filmmaking is, I would like this amount of money. We're going to make more money, so you get to make money.
Go watch The Producers.
Yeah. But yeah, I did a Kickstarter. One of my buddies, I was talking to him, and I was, you know, actually from doing this, Mike Young is trying to get me to the city of Vidalia, or whoever is, he's building a course in Vidalia, Georgia.
A municipal golf project, yeah, in Vidalia, Georgia, capitalizing on the popularity of the golf boom down here in the southeast sand belt.
Exactly, and they got the sand there, so he was very excited about building, but they've run into some problems. He was trying to get me on the film there and actually get paid, because I wasn't, I mean, I was doing this all on my own, and I mean, Ashley offered to give me money, and I was like, I don't think you can pay to have a documentary made about you. I don't think that's how that works.
You can, but
that's not what I wanted.
They call it something different.
Exactly. And he was doing it at the kind of his heart, not as any sort of ploy. But I was frustrated because the Vidalia thing fell through, because the golf course production has been pushed back. I hope I'm allowed to talk about that, Mike.
Yeah, he mentioned that, okay, on the Friday.
So they've been having problems. So that wasn't working out. I was complaining to somebody. He's like, just fundraise it. You know, he's like, even so, you shouldn't be using the money from that to make it anyway. So he kind of pushed me into doing that. But the short film is...
Are we in post at this point?
It's done. I just finished the sound. I had to pay somebody to do the sound, because it's a pretty big learning curve to do the sound, to hopefully be good enough to hopefully play at big festivals. I mean, I'm sending it to every kind of festival, low and high tier, but you have to have good sound to get into a good festival. You got to have good sound for it to be a good movie.
Right. That was what I told you, my Australian friends got me into the podcast in game, and that was the only... He didn't care what I said. All he cared about was he said, if you don't have quality sound, they will turn it off.
No, the best example is the Blair Witch Project. I mean, they filmed it on handheld cameras, but the sound is legit professional sound, and that made millions of dollars. If you take Casablanca and you put the sound through a tin can, you don't want to watch it after 2 minutes. So it is very important. But it's done and it's being submitted to festivals. It's about a couple at the end of their relationship and just kind of that part of a relationship where you know it's done, but you're still in love with that person and you don't feel heard, but you also aren't listening, and kind of just a short film exploring that.
Because we don't have any of that going on.
Exactly, exactly. And also the being trapped in the last 3 months of a lease and being too broke to break it, you know? So, yeah, I try to really, I think in the Kickstarter, I said something to the extent of, I hope, you know, I want to show people in a painful way their past, or if you've been lucky enough not to be in one of those relationships, what it could be like, and not in a negative way too, because I think it's also important to show, like, I hope I showed in the short that these people do still love each other. Like, there are tender moments. I don't think enough films show that in toxic relationships. They only show the fighting, but a lot of times we fight because we do love people. I mean, not all the time.
If you didn't care, you wouldn't fight. You just walk.
You just walk out, and I think that was I tried to show that.
Well, we'll follow up and show people where they can see it. And after they watch that, they should definitely watch From Red Clays to Fairways to pick their spirits right back up.
Yeah.
You've mentioned a couple of movies and direction. What were your big influences as a filmmaker? Like, you don't have to give me favorites, yeah, but things that moved you and got you from movie fan to following your creative impulse.
Yeah, I mean, I've always loved, like, the behind-the-scenes kind of footage stuff. I think the best example of how to have a process to make something, because filmmaking is a very weird art form where a lot of it has to do with scheduling and planning and payroll. It's a very, like, 50-50 split between being artistic and being a business person. And I think the best person to do that was Stanley Kubrick. I do love his movies. Maybe not all of them are my favorite movies, but I respect him as an artist and businessman more than anybody else. And through him, I learned that he did... consciously, I copied his path, where he was a photographer, and then he made a documentary, and then he started making films. But I think learning photography first is a very important lesson. And I'm kind of more inspired by photography than movies in a lot of ways. Because I think if you can make a still image look interesting, you can make a moving image look interesting easy. But it's very hard to make a non-moving image from real life interesting, in my opinion.
I completely agree. Why does that grab us, just as humans? Are we so visual that...
Well, Joel Meyerowitz and Gary Winogrand would be able to explain it a lot better, and anything I would say would be ripping off a YouTube video that I saw of them, or Henri Cartier-Bresson, but it's just like... Because when you're taking a photo... When you're taking a photo, what you're also doing is you're making a conscious decision of what to leave out of that frame. And that's almost more important than what is in the frame, is what you decided to put inside of it and leave out of it. But I mean, I think it's interesting just to look at humans. And I think with a still image, you get to study it more. Because when an image is moving, like in a movie or in television or just watching real life, everything's happening so quick, it can scare you, startle you, or be overstimulating.
It's control.
Yeah. So you get to just go, oh, look at this. I get to look at this person's up their nostril, their pores, their hand, and really, like...
And you get to do it on your schedule.
Yeah, exactly. And digest. I like on your schedule. That's good.
On your own schedule. Yeah. Humans like control. Either they want total control or lack of control.
Yeah.
In 18 holes, I experience both.
Yeah. I was going to say, I feel both constantly.
Well, that's interesting. The photography, the journey.
Yeah. But right now, Michael Haneke, I kind of briefly talked about him when we were playing golf, but he makes very They're like weirdly, they look very sleek and professional, and but the subject matter can be very dark. And I think he does a good job. Like, I like movies that show you but don't tell you. You know, we were talking earlier as well. Like, you watch a sitcom, you know how the episode's going to end by the first few lines.
That works in golf too. You give me the predictable. Okay, this is just the same. Hit it down the fairway. There's some containment mounding.
Mm-hmm.
Like, I've played that hole 1,000 times.
Way to tie it back to golf, buddy.
But you, I can second.
Yeah,
buddy, I practiced golf for 10 years. We can work out this all day. But the, you know, you give me a little mystery. You obscure that sight line a little bit.
Mm-hmm.
I'm going to be intrigued.
Yeah, because you want to look around the corner. Right. And people are smarter than a lot of people put on, you know. Or maybe some filmmakers think they're so smart that they have to explain what they're doing. But I think the best respect the audience. Or like Mike or any good golf architect, they respect their player to make a decision, like it or not. Like, while they're playing, and then when they're done, they can like it or not, but they're gonna do something that's a little different.
You mentioned something you said struck me from my time with the guys at Park Mammoth, my entree into McKellar Magazine. That's the course that was reborn down in Park City, Kentucky. And it was a design build. It was two young guys. This was their first shot by redoing that course. And one of the things that struck them was they knew how to build. They knew how to shape. Like, they knew how to use equipment, and they had a vision. What they weren't prepared for, they said at one time, even with their design build model, they were having to manage 31 different contractors and subcontractors because, you know, they weren't cement guys. They weren't. What did you learn? Were you prepared for spending so much time scheduling, arranging people, material, equipment, post, versus just the artistic, you know, trying to catch the shot, trying to frame?
Yeah, I mean, I didn't feel like from when I finished writing the script, from when I started the Kickstarter to basically when we finished filming, I mean, obviously setting up a shot is pretty artistic, but you're also thinking analytically about how to get the emotion out of the script, because the creative part was writing the script. I didn't really feel like until I got to editing that I was creative at all, which is fun and not fun. I was very surprised at how organized I got everything. But the age-old best advice is just to hire the best people. And I didn't have a lot of money, but I found the best six-person team that I ever could have found. And that makes everything easier. You know, as long as I had the schedule and they knew what they needed to do, they got it done. And I didn't want to be holding a boom mic while also doing it, so I hired a sound guy, and he was the best person I could have hired. I actually did hire one person before, and he kind of fought with me on the price, which is respectable. It's a hard world out here. And then when we agreed on a price, he said, all right, I'll give you a call tomorrow, and he, you know, you can tell me what you need, what I can do for you. And he goes, well, I think for $200 a day, this and that should be fine. And I said, no, like, that's not going to work. Like, that attitude is not going to work, you know. So being cognizant of, like, bringing the people together is very important for any business, but very important for actors needing to be vulnerable. The set cannot be a contentious place.
Is it chaos? Was it more chaotic or less chaotic than you imagined?
It was a lot more fun than I thought it was going to be. I thought I was going to be really stressed. Like, I'm a very laid-back person, but when it's something I care about, I'm disgustingly stressed and controlling in a way. And I was very happy with how I was going, yeah, that looks good, you know? Or, like, you know, we're, like, you know, like, setting up something and joking about it, and it was stressful, but the kind of stressful that you want to do again, which is all you really want in life, is like the high to be good enough where it didn't kick your ass and you want to go back and do it again.
Well, I can't wait for what the next project is.
Me neither.
I made my kids sit down and watch From Red Clays to Fairways.
What did they say? Did they like it? Were they bored?
They did. No, they have been exposed to a lot of different golf things. Like Park Mammoth is a really high-end, by Kentucky standards, daily fee golf course.
Yeah.
But they're also, and every after Christmas the last few years, we've gone to Hilton Head. Mm-hmm. And so they will go and play Atlantic Dunes with me, which is a full-priced resort course. It has longleaf tees, which is so it's got tees that max out at like 3,500 yards, maybe even less for 18 holes.
Oh, that's cool.
Yeah, and there's seven sets of tees. So it's this whole thing. Bill Bergen developed it from Atlanta. He's an Atlanta-based architect. It's how far do you hit your driver, and it's a mathematical formula based on that. And so they can go out and share the golf course with me. But that's a really, high-end experience. We also go and walk Gabe Brewer Jr. Picadome or Kearney Hill. So they've seen all different types. So I think, especially for my 9-year-old, I think he grasped the subject matter of what Ashley and what Mike were talking about, even Tad. Yeah. I was happy for them to see kind of the community that it takes to run any business.
Sure.
But especially something that is a labor of love, because they have their kids, they have their interests, and I ask them what they want to, ask them what they want to do for a living, and it changes from day to day, week to week, month to month.
Good.
But the 6-year-old didn't want to sit maybe all the way through. But,
I can respect that.
But again, to something we touched on earlier, it's a professional film. It's good, even on watching on an iPad, like it's good imagery. It's people talking, telling a story. They love a story. My little guy's just learning to read. He's read 5 books, and he'll tell you. So he's read, 5. It's like some Gerald and Piggy, some Who Wants to Buy a Rhinoceros. And so he's getting the idea of storytelling. And there's good stories are just good stories.
Sure. Well, thank you. Tell them I said thank you. I'm interested in your 9-year-old. He sounds like a pretty cool cat.
He is. He's.
I mean, he read Bob Rotella's Golf is Not a Game of Perfect in one day. That's.
He read it before I did. He knocked it out in a day. The kid is a voracious reader. He was reading by kindergarten.
I love it.
He gets all the prize. Like when I was a kid, the reward was a personal pan pizza. Like if you did your summer reading, Pizza Hut had this program. They'd sell you this.
That was pre-stuffed crust because it was,
Oh yeah, this was not. This is when you actually had to go into Pizza Hut. Like you played Q-bert.
Screw that.
You needed a handful of quarters to go play the actual video games. But yeah, they got it. And so one of the things I like about golf is that, I coach their teams. I've coached soccer and baseball, indoor soccer. I never played soccer a day in my life. But I watch enough English Premier League and know the principles of spacing. And if you're just loud with kids and you know their names, they'll pretty much listen.
Good to know.
It's true. I bark at them like a drill sergeant with a big smile on my face. But one of the cool things about golf is they know it's something I'm passionate about. Mm. So I'm not trying to push it on them, but they know it's something we can do together. Mm. And the trick is you let them drive the cart once and they're hooked.
Oh, yeah.
That's the dirty little secret. It's not, they want to flush a golf shot or make a putt. But you let them drive that cart like Evel Knievel just one time and they can't wait to get back.
I've used it to have girlfriends actually come out and, watch me play golf so I didn't have to go alone.
Let them drive the cart?
Yeah, and they're hooked.
Yes, fascinating little dudes.
little dudes.
Hope to bring them, to someplace like this. They were scheduled actually to come down. We had a family situation that they weren't able to come down last summer to see the premiere, but they would have loved it. They wouldn't have sat still. They would have been running around, and then they would have watched some of the movie.
They could have hung out with me. I wasn't anywhere near the screen while I was playing. I would have taken them happily.
How nerve-wracking. Like, I don't listen to my podcast much, and I definitely, I will not go back and read the early blog posts on One Beard Golfer because it is just horrifically bad writing and bad subject matter coverage. I'm talking about all the things that would never It's like, oh, this is just from the Golf Digest hack playbook from 15 years ago. But how nerve-wracking is it consuming your finished product?
I mean, I definitely wanted people to like it, but I don't think I stood away because of that. I think I had seen it so many times from editing it. I was not sick of it, but I was like, I don't need to watch it again. You know, I'd probably watched it 30 times within the past 2 days just to make sure everything was what it needed to be, and there wasn't like a small tweak I could make to fix it or like sound. So I was like, I don't need to watch it. And I mentioned the officiating the wedding, and funny story about that is everybody was looking into the sun while I was speaking, so everybody had this kind of scowl look on their face. And as I'm up there, I'm like, oh my god, they hate this. My arms are bombing. I'm Larry David bombing right now, which we share a birthday. Funny story.
Oh.
I hold that true and dear to my heart. But after, when everybody liked it so much, I was like, you never know. Like, you can't read somebody's body language. So I stood far enough away where I didn't have to see it, or I didn't have to, like, I wasn't like, well, that person just turned away, they don't like, you know, like studying everybody, which is a disease I have. So I stood far enough away where I didn't see that, but close enough where I could hear a laugh or hear a you know, and that's all I needed. And I just wanted to sit. And a kind of emotional thing about it, just like sit and enjoy the moment that it was playing, that I had finished it, that we had, the event was successful. There was maybe, I don't know, maybe you have a better guess, but like, what did you say, like 150 people here?
A couple, 200.
You think, say 200.
Yeah.
So like 200 people I don't really know, but they love the fields. And like, I just sat there. I smoked my cigarette, which I'm sorry, Mom. I looked at the stars and I listened, and I just like took a moment to like just be grateful that it was happening, more than being scared. You know, I was just grateful that I had accomplished this goal, and it felt like it was something I was supposed to be doing, that I needed to do, and that I'd finished it, and that I was going to take this and move forward with it. And that's kind of why I went away. But I would have also watched your kids if they needed, if they were bothering you.
They would have been rolling down the hills on 18th Green. I've seen that story play out. It's a great film. One of the reasons it made such an impression on me, because it's, yeah, okay, the character's unique. The Fields is a special place, and it is a special community. But I feel like there are golf courses all across the country that are candidates for that can fit that same story.
Yeah.
Which is so different from what I think a lot of the general public, and especially in municipal golf, a lot of the powers that be, they don't see the community aspect of it. You know, it's just either it's making money or it's not, and golf is just rich people, and it gets into classism and a whole bunch, and they don't see that there's an investment by people to make it successful. Otherwise, it won't work.
Yeah.
You know, there are too many mom and pop places, all kinds of public golf. The Blue Bloods are going to be fine. The Met Club is always going to be okay.
But I mean, even some private courses I've worked at, where if a few people don't really give a shit, it struggles.
Yeah.
You know, if a superintendent doesn't care, it's going to struggle. But yeah, I mean, Ashley said that in the documentary, because I mean, somebody like Larry, who's been on the grass almost every single day for almost 30 years, I think.
The real superintendent here, no matter what the title.
He never admits to it, but he is. There are people that do that all across the country, but I was lucky enough to film Larry and to tell their story. I think when I was editing, there were like three lenses I could have chose, and I could have just done exactly what they were doing and how they were fixing the course. I could have told the history till now, or I could have told the macro of how what they're doing is similar to what a lot of public golf courses are, and is breaking away from what a lot of the private clubs were, and is what a lot of people like us and a lot of people younger that are getting into golf really all they want to do is go play golf at a place that is fun and interesting and affordable. Because who the fuck wants to pay $300 every time they play golf? No offense.
I got two little kids. Cheaper is better.
Yeah. But you can still get quality for a cheap price. It doesn't have to be a contingent that expensive is better.
Yeah. Mike Young is a master of that messaging, that if you're going to build a golf course, it doesn't cost any more to build a good golf course than it does to build a bad one. Go ahead and build a good golf course.
Yeah.
I get you out of here on this one. This is a traditional getaway question.
Okay.
Not going to make you pick a favorite golf course or anything like that. What I am interested in, everybody's got that one golf course, that one round they wish they could get back or get back to. So what's the place that you've played? It can be sentimental. It can be some place you play. You had a crap round and what's the golf course you want to get back to?
I don't know golf course, but playing, it was a weird thing where I didn't start playing until I was like 15. By that point, my dad had kind of stopped playing, and he was like a very good amateur. He played in a few mid-ams, blah, blah, blah. So I wasn't playing when he was playing. I mean, I was too young, and then when I was playing, he'd kind of like retired, and then when he would play, he wouldn't be as good, and it'd piss him off, so then he'd only want to play every once in a while when I could finally get him out there. And then my grandfather, once I started playing, he was getting a little too old to like really play. I mean, he used to play like every single day. So what I wish is in an alternate universe, we all were at the same time playing and enjoying it and can play more often. Because when I did play with each of them or all together, it was a special time.
That's awesome.
Hey, thanks for stopping by for this episode of the Blind Shots Podcast. And again, a big thank you to Hagan O'Neill for sitting down with me, and a big thanks to Ashley Young and Ace down at the Fields for being such great hosts, both for this interview as well as last year for the McKellar event and the world premiere screening of From Red Clay to Fairways. McKellar Golf Journal helped sponsor, produce, gave encouragement to Hagan so that the film could get properly made. I hope you have indeed viewed the film. It's free on YouTube from Palmer Pictures and freely embedded for your convenience over at onebeardedgolfer.com. And yes, I even included a link to the movie in the show notes for you, Adrian. Hope you watch it. Hope you enjoy it. Hope you'll share it. Also hope that you'll consider making the pilgrimage to the Fields. It's an awesome golf course, part of a great golf community, and certainly worthy of a detour if you're in or traveling through Georgia or even eastern Alabama. I sincerely hope you enjoyed what you heard here today. One of the things we pride ourselves on here is the unpredictable nature of our Blind Shots podcast. You just never know what we're going to be talking about. And if you didn't like it today, I'm sorry. I will try to do better next time. Maybe talk a little more golf. But don't hold your breath. Until then, sit up straight, drink more water. And if you have the opportunity, do decide to go for it and take dead aim. Most important thing is that I hit record, because the number of times I've done that.
Yeah.